Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a little bit about the development of the personal computer and the internet, something about where we have come from and where we are heading. And our guest for the program is Jonathan Zittrain. He's professor of internet governance and regulation at Oxford University. He's also co-founder of the Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, and is the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title is The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. Yale University Press is the publisher, in which he makes the argument that the internet certainly has changed our lives in many ways. And some people would argue that that's a good thing. It has increased our access to information. It's given us some new ways to communicate. At the same time, we know that there is a downside. Certainly, there are things about personal computing and about the internet that people don't like, things like spam and viruses and spyware and invasions of privacy. And there are some people, among them I think our guest, who worry that if we aggressively attack these kinds of security problems, if we really go after these things that we don't like, and in a particular way, that we'll be losing something, the thing perhaps that we value most about the internet, and that is freedom, broadly defined. This morning we'll be talking about his book, The Future of the Internet, How to Stop It. As we talk, questions, comments from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that line is good. That number is good anywhere you might be happening to hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the internet, either way, use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, if you have questions, comments, you can certainly join us. The only thing we ask of people who call in is just that people try to keep their comments brief, just so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody who's listening is welcome to join us. Professor Zittrain, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I think the way to start, perhaps, is as you do, as a way of talking a little bit about where we started on this journey and where we might be headed, and just to talk a little bit about two devices. Interestingly enough, they were both introduced by the same guy, Steve Jobs. And these two things are the Apple II, which was one of the first home computers, and the iPhone. Let's just talk about those two things.
Well, there's exactly 30 years in between the introduction of each of those devices and the 30-year journey that's represented from start to finish, I think says a lot about where we might be headed with our information technology. The introduction by a 21-year-old Steve Jobs in 1977 of the Apple II computer was notable because this was something intended for a geek audience. He unveiled it at the West Coast Computer Fair, described as 10,000 walking, talking computer freaks, the kind of people that would build their own clock rather than buy one. And it was produced in a way that it was a single molded plastic case, this convenient object that you could get. Of course, when you take it home, what it gives you is a blinking cursor. The thing was incomplete. And Jobs just figured that you would figure out how to program it and to do something useful with it. And, of course, if one person figures out something useful to do, that person can circulate the new software to others, and Steve Jobs doesn't care at all. It's just part of the whole system. And that was perhaps best exemplified 2 years later when two guys, Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston, invented VisiCalc, the first digital spreadsheet ever. And VisiCalc needed an Apple II for it to run. And suddenly businesses around the country and then the world were like, wow, where have you been all our lives? They started getting VisiCalc, and to get it, they needed Apple IIs. So Apple IIs are flying off the shelves. And Apple has no idea why. They had to commission market research to figure out why their box had become so popular. And so for this bookend, I think of this as what I call a generative technology, something that's not entirely complete, that relies on unnamed, unaccredited, unknown third parties to make it better, and that allows those people to circulate the ways in which they make it better to others, maybe for money, maybe for fun, and that group of people then makes the technology improve in a kind of continuous way. That's one bookend of this 30-year span.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and then the other would be the iPod, which is in a sense the complete opposite. It's something, while it will do a lot of amazing things for you, it's not something where you as a user can really interact with it other than to do those things that it is programmed to do. The Apple folks, they can get in there and mess around with it, but you can't.
Well, that's true of the iPod and later of the iPhone when first introduced in 2007. And the same Steve Jobs was very upfront about this. He said, look, we want to control everything that's on the phone because you don't want to load in three applications from a guy named Dan and Bob and then have the phone not work anymore, which is why it's more like an iPod than a computer. The iPhone, of course, was a huge hit. That was seriously flying off the shelves. And during the course of the year, some people figured out how to program the iPhone despite Apple not wanting them to. And Apple ended up sending out a press release that said, we should caution you that if you are not careful, you may find that you reprogram your iPhone and then it'll just die because we'll send it a software update that noticed that you reprogrammed it. Now in 2008, it's really interesting, a year later, Steve Jobs has said a version of Uncle. He said, okay, we're going to let outsiders reprogram the phone. But the way in which he's done it, I think, is very, very instructive. He has said, okay, you can write new applications for the phone, and you can share them with others, but you can't just give them to people the way that Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston could give away VisiCalc or sell it. If you have a new application, you have to pay Apple money for the privilege of becoming a developer. You have to wait sometimes up to 6 months for approval to write code for the phone. And then when you write your code, if you want to distribute it to anybody else, it has to go through the iPhone application store. And Steve Jobs and Apple approve every single piece of code that will run on the phone. And that's what I call a contingently generative technology. And should it become ubiquitous, and that's a big if, I'm very worried about it because it means that truly disruptive innovations of the sort that we've seen again and again with the Internet and the PC over the past 30 years may well get nipped in the bud, either because they don't suit Apple's business model or because somebody else can figure out how to make a lawsuit out of it and give an order to Apple that says, you must kill this application.
Hmm. So essentially your argument is that your concern is that we have moved from or are moving from this kind of generative model that gives people the opportunity to get into a particular piece of technology and look at it and see how it works and decide, can I make this work better? Can I develop new applications, something that nobody has ever thought about? And then I could share that with everybody else and we'll all be very excited and we'll be able to do these new things with it. And that's the way that it grows and we develop new applications. Your argument is if we are moving towards this other thing where everything's proprietary and people cannot do that, or maybe they can do it to some limited extent if it is approved by the manufacturer, the people who put out the product and hold the licenses, that essentially that we are losing that potential that got us to where we are now.
Yes, and the amazing thing to me is that this movement away from generative technologies isn't happening because somebody passed a law that made them illegal or something. It's the market itself saying, whoa, these generative technologies are so open that anybody in the world can write some code and 10 minutes later have it running on 10%, 20%, 30% of the machines out there, that actually has its own dangers as well. So in trying to boil this book down to a bumper sticker, I found it actually a little difficult because it sounds like I'm not satisfied either way. On the one hand, the generative technologies that I'm so excited about are starting to show their true age and vulnerabilities as the thing has gone mainstream. And on the other hand, the kinds of solutions that so far the market is putting forward, namely these locked down or contingently generative devices like the iPhone, have their own problems. And much of the book is spent trying to figure out how to steer a path through the middle of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that certainly speaking for myself and people like me, I don't want to have to write my own software. You know, I'm one of those people that if you can show me a device that really does a wide range of things, like the iPhone, for example, I think the iPhone's I don't happen to have one, but I've seen them at work, and I think, well, those things are pretty cool.
Right.
And I can imagine using something like that, you know. And for me, I'd say, well, it's not, if it's not generative, if it is tethered, if somehow I've made a Faustian bargain with Steve Jobs that, you know, as long as I continue to pay him and don't mess around with it, that it'll continue to do what I want, that maybe for somebody like me, I would say, well, you know, that's okay, because I'm not at that level where I want to get into it any deeper than what I need to do to get it to do what I need it to do. So I guess maybe particularly for somebody like me and for a lot of people who use these devices but, you know, are not geeks, not computer geeks, and nothing against them, then you have to convince us why it is that moving in the direction that we are is such a bad thing.
Yeah, I think that's true. And to me, I'm ready to take up that challenge. I think that if we return generative technologies to the land of people only who would rather build their own clock rather than buy it, that we really miss a huge opportunity. That a world where most people use these appliances that can't be changed very easily or that are very highly controlled, and in which only a small percentage of the geeks off in the corner swapping interesting new software, means that that stuff can't catch fire, especially when often how useful that software is a function of how many people have adopted it. So if you think of something like Skype, which is free internet telephony from one computer to another, if you can't Skype your mother-in-law or your friends who aren't nerds, Skype isn't very useful. It's only when you can forward an email to somebody that isn't very skilled and just say, hey, check this out, just click on this link, and 5 minutes later, I'll be able to call you or vice versa for free, even though, you know, we're across the ocean from each other. That's the kind of cool stuff that I think we would lose if people, quote-unquote, rationally give up the opportunity to just click on that link.
Mm-hmm. And well, at the same time, what you say, we do, if we continue with the kind of generative model that we have had, that we do indeed have problems that need to be addressed. And they're not just something on the level of nuisance. We do have people who are writing malicious viruses that can do a lot of damage. We do have the problem of spam. We do have issues with privacy and internet security. So the openness that on the one hand is a positive thing that allows for innovation does have its downsides. And I'm sure you would say yes. And that is something that we also need to address.
Yes. And I'm interested basically in doubling down. The kind of models that brought us the PC and that brought it to prominence and that brought us the internet and brought the internet to prominence require a kind of we're all in this together mentality, as naive as it may sound. That's what drives the internet and makes it work at a very fundamental, and non-optional level. And I'm looking to take some of that spirit and deploy it to a layer of security so that together we can actually work to make it so that you click on that link, you'll be aware if it's something that's evil rather than something that's cool.
Hmm. Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580 is Jonathan Zittrain. He holds the chair in Internet Governance and Regulation at Oxford University. He's a principal of the Oxford Internet Institute. He is also the Jack and Lillian Berkman Visiting Professor for Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School, where he co-founded Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society in 1996, and has written and is active on a lot of issues, including the battles for control of digital property and content, cryptography, electronic privacy, and so forth. And he is the author of a recently published book. The title of his book is The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, and Yale University Press is the publisher. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. It's perhaps interesting to talk a little bit about, or have you talk a little bit about, how it is that even at the beginning, things developed along this generative model and not maybe right from the very start, someone might have said, well, what really most people want is a very practical kind of appliance. And they're not going to want to have to create applications. They want something they can pull out of the box and plug in and with a relatively small number of keystrokes, get it right away to do its thing. How is it that we ended up with the kind of computers that we have?
Well, the appliance-sized model has been with us all along. And if you look at what rational market actors, you know, big firms were thinking of for modern consumer information technology in the 1970s and 1980s, they were thinking iPhone style. They were not thinking cool style. I mean, it took this 21-year-old upstart to produce this personal computer that then ignited kind of out of left field. That's why it was called the personal computer and yet turned out to be so important for business as well, ignited the information revolution with the PC. And and the competing devices there were these smart word processors. Some listeners may remember using fancy smart typewriters that had a little LCD screen or even a full CRT, a full monitor, but you would just turn the thing on. It would give you a main menu, you know, what kind of paper do you want to write today? And that's how you would write your paper. It was a dedicated word processor with a toll-free support line, and, you know, it acted like an appliance. You couldn't reprogram it. And the same thing was true of the network space. The bets placed by corporate actors were on proprietary networks like CompuServe or AOL or Prodigy or The Source or Minitel in France. And these were services designed to collect a certain amount of money from you per hour for connect time and to give you something you'd want. And so in that sense, they were market responsive. You could get AP News, and there was a CB simulator on CompuServe. But out of left field came the Internet, which was built without a business plan, without a CEO, and without a profit model, importantly, because in order to know who was online at what time and how long they were spending so that they could be billed on a service like CompuServe or AOL, it dictated certain network architecture that turned out not to be as good as the Internet. The Internet had a certain freedom because it didn't have to make any money. For example, you can get on the Internet by connecting to anybody already on the Internet. You can grow at the edges, in other words, not having to always connect at the center. In fact, the Internet has no center. And that kind of architecture is enabled only by the freedom of not having to figure out how to charge everybody something. It's also why, even to this day, we don't know how many Internet users there are, because there's no central repository or registry of users and their identities and how long they're spending online. So my claim is that out of left field came these more generative, inclusive technologies, and they took off in part because they worked better, and also they had this wonderful subsidy that there wasn't anybody really out to subvert it. I mean, it was amazing to me that it took about 25 years before it occurred to anybody to send spam. There was no limitation on sending it through the 70s and 80s. It just took a while before somebody, it turns out it was lawyers who did it at great length at first, said, wait, we can send free email to a bunch of email addresses, and if, you know, only a small percentage respond, we're still in good shape. So we had this subsidy of goodwill and of, like, the bad guys just not noticing what was going on here in the backwater. That subsidy has now evaporated, and in part that's what I think is occasioning the shift back to gated communities and to more controllable and controlled technology.
Yeah, I still think it's really fascinating when you think about this, the fact that at some point what people were thinking of as the model for linking people up, linking one computer to another, making it possible for people to communicate, giving people the access to information, the model essentially was the phone company. And they thought that that was what it was going to be like. And that, as you say, because of the Internet, something that at least at some point very few people had envisioned, it developed along completely different lines, although I suppose it's also true that now there are people like the phone company and other big telecommunications interests that are trying to figure out how best they can grab onto it and make money off of it.
Yes, I think that's all true. I think that as a generative technology starts in a backwater, doesn't have the leaders caring a whole lot about profit or thinking that their profit will come from monopolizing and controlling it, but rather from just freeing it up and letting people use it as they will, as you see those technologies become popular and then go mainstream and attract more standard models of profit, then you start to see attempts at enclosure. It's just a natural move to want to say, as a company, what's my comparative advantage here? How can I reinforce it? How can I, you know, outcompete the others who are doing the same thing? And for that, you want to get out of the commodity business. You don't just want it to be a platform that rolls off an assembly line that others can program. you want people coming back for more. And that's also why I think we see in the personal computer space a move towards thinking of things as a service rather than as a product, that your relationship with Apple is just beginning when you buy an iPhone. It's not like the PC where you buy it, you've got it, and then it's up to you what to do with it, and you rarely hear from the vendor again. It's you buy that thing, and it's getting updates every hour from the original vendor controlling how it will work. And I think that leads to some very interesting quirks and some worrisome ones, for which we've seen a couple examples of them recently. And I almost think of it by analogy to a toaster that you might have. That's a standard product, right? You buy a toaster, you make toast, you're done. And if I imagine the toaster as a service rather than as a product, it means I might come down one Wednesday morning, and before breakfast, I see that the toaster has a sign on it that says, "Congratulations, you've got the summer update. There's now a third slot." And I'm like, that's interesting. And then I come back the next day, and there's a sign that says, "We apologize. There were problems with the update. We've rolled it back, and now you're back to two slots. And we apologize for any toast that was crushed in the rollback." And then the following week, it's making orange juice. And at that point, you realize, wow, I didn't buy a toaster. I bought a relationship with a company for a breakfast-oriented service. And they're trying to make me happy. They think I want orange juice. But it means that you're no longer in control of your technology the way that you might have been before.
We have a couple of callers here who would bring them into the conversation, starting with someone who is listening in Urbana and on line one.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm curious what you think about the recent lawsuit. I think it's Viacom and Google, where I think that the court said that Google had to give Viacom the addresses of everybody who had ever gotten a YouTube video or something. I mean, who cares about whether you win a lawsuit or not with that kind of information? You've just gotten $1 billion database.
Well, that's a very good question. And, of course, this YouTube Viacom lawsuit has been going on for a while, basically with the content providers angry that a service like YouTube can offer, submitted by its members, its subscribers, so many videos that are clips of shows produced by the producers and without their authorization being copied. And there's a system that has become sort of established called Notice and Takedown, where the producer is supposed to identify a clip, and at that point, YouTube will take it right down. In fact, YouTube basically offers the bigger content providers like Viacom a console, so the Viacom can go in and take down any video it wants, with YouTube kind of just riding herd over it. Viacom isn't still fully happy with this because they don't want to have to do the hunting. They would prefer that YouTube slash Google go ahead and say, I see, I shouldn't just take down this particular clip of the Colbert Report. I should take all other similar clips from the Colbert Report down as soon as they keep popping up from subscribers. So that's what the overall lawsuit is about. Now, the piece that you're asking about is just sort of a skirmish within the lawsuit that's really attracted, I think rightly, some public attention, which is that Viacom wanted to show, they want to establish, that pretty much when people use YouTube, they're using it for ripped-off Viacom-style content rather than trading interesting viral videos that they produce among themselves. That's kind of the point they want to be able to establish. And to do it, they got a court to affirm a subpoena to YouTube that says, we want the viewing habits of everybody on YouTube. We want to know everything everybody's watched so that then we can crunch the numbers and show that what they're watching is basically pirated stuff. I got to confess, I was pretty amazed that the court went ahead and said that that subpoena should go forward. It seems like a fairly major invasion of privacy and of sensitive information in exchange for a fairly minor point that maybe could be established some other reasonable way, such as through surveys or, you know, a representative sampling of data that's fully anonymized, something like that. Now, my guess is, I haven't looked closely enough at the order to know this for sure, but my guess is that Viacom is under order not to use that data for anything else. It's not like they could suddenly start marketing stuff to people that says, you know, oh, I see you like videos that feature bikinis, you know, why don't you buy this suntan lotion? My guess is they're not allowed to use it for that purpose. Could they secretly go off and do it? Yeah, but, I mean, you know, a court order is a court order. It's still, though, to me, very unsettling that that would happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I think it points to something, and certainly I know is a concern, something that you address, and that is with many of these devices, these things that you call tethered devices, where it essentially we still have this connection between us and the device and the person who made it, and so you could be talking about an iPhone, you could be talking about a TiVo, you could be talking about a lot of different things, that the people who provide the service are in the position to look at, monitor, try to control what it is we do with that device.
Yes, and I see a couple examples of that already happening. One is another lawsuit, actually, involving TiVo and EchoStar. TiVo, of course, produces digital video recorders. EchoStar makes dish systems for satellite TV, and they started incorporating DVR functionality into their systems. And TiVo sued them over it and said that that was infringing a TiVo patent, or 10. And TiVo won in a Texas federal court and got $70 million judgment against EchoStar. And then they asked for more. Their lawyers are very creative. They got the judge to order EchoStar within 30 days to remotely disable the DVR, the EchoStar DVR, just to kill it. So, you know, this is like the toaster update. You now have no slots because this toaster was found to infringe a patent. Have a nice day. The case has been on appeal. EchoStar just lost the appeal. So it's actually very interesting to see if over the next month or so, EchoStar is going to have to go ahead, pull the trigger, and do this update that turns the EchoStar into an Echo brick. And that's a phenomenon, I think, that should it happen, will really make some waves because we'll start to realize just how controllable these technologies are. If you buy a mousetrap that turns out to 5 years later infringe somebody's patent, you know, the maker of the mousetrap maybe has to pay damages, but you're not going to have the patent police kick down your door and demand that you produce the mousetrap that you bought.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. I have another caller here. We'll get right to it. I just want to very quickly introduce again the guest, Jonathan Zittrain. He holds the chair in Internet Governance and Regulation at Oxford University. He's also the Jack and Lillian Berkman Visiting Professor for Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School, where he co-founded Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And he is the author of the book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. It is published by the Yale University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have someone here and where we are to talk with in Champaign County, line 2. Hello? Caller there, line 2?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, okay. The point I'd like to make, I hope it isn't too much of a digression. I think I'll bring it back to the central idea. But the Internet came out of, you know, military funding, our DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Administration's and cooperation with academia, and that was this milieu. There's a lot of presentation that it was some kind of free market development, and certainly wasn't. That's a point that I think needs to be brought to the attention of people who just gloss over that. What I'd like to look, I mean, the idea that the Internet is so much different than any other media is true, but I think that looking at the history of introduction of new media in the past can be insightful. And I'm thinking of AM radio, basically. WLL is one of the small number of AM stations that, you know, has continuity back to almost the inception of use of AM radio. The idea there is that during the Depression, economic turmoil, the AMs that were licensed to community organizations, hobbyists, trade unions, school districts, were just all absorbed. And I just, you know, I don't know how you'll react to this, but it just seems to me that the same sort of thing is happening at a higher scale with the Internet, where corporate dominance, which, you know, was involved in at the inception, but the interactivity and the you know, community based part of it is being, you know, obsoleted in this sort of the same fashion that AM radio, and I think it's as opposed to completely emphasizing the completely new nature of this new media, I think looking at the history is a good point. So I hope you'll take it. Hello?
Yeah, we got you.
That comment, I agree with you, I think, 100%. The first part of your point, I think, is well taken in that the market did not produce the initial protocols and structures and pilot stuff for the Internet. And in a sense, yes, it was Defense Department. Of course, it was Defense Department funding that was in the category for, we have no idea how this will help us kill people or defend our people, but we just want to see it happen. We want good things to happen, kind of the most general category of Defense Department funding, and later the National Science Foundation, sort of out of DOD aegis. But you're right, it's not the free market, and it came cheap. The entire amount of money that the U.S. government spent on the Internet between 1969, the first bit flowing over what would become the Internet, and probably 1992 or so when the subsidies stopped, was less than the initial IPO of just one Internet company, Yahoo, around 95. So we got this pretty cheap, and we got it through a public subsidy model that has paid amazing dividends and then, of course, invited the standard corporate model to then refine it and deploy it. And, you know, that's how you now have for-profit ISPs and everything else. And I wouldn't want to minimize the role of .com in this. It's just that it all got started out of .org, .edu, and .gov. Now, the second point that ties into that, as you say, is this question about, well, the things start in a backwater, and they're kind of fun and, you know, informal and not obsessed with profit. And then they end up in a zone of corporate dominance, or what you might even call professionalization rather than amateurization. And I think we've seen that with a lot of technologies. Deborah Spahr at the Harvard Business School has written a great book called Ruling the Waves that talks about how that happened with AM and FM radio. Citizens Band radio for a while has been thought of as the province of informal kind of grassroots sort of stuff, and there was a brief era when CB hit the mainstream. The movies with Burt Reynolds, Smokey and the Bear, helped propel it into prominence, and cars started to be sold with CB radio built in. Of course, there, CB radio has rules that say you're not allowed to do anything entertaining. The FCC could come after you if you actually sing a song or tell a story over Citizens Band radio. It's got to just be, you know, informational. And that, I think, has helped keep that clamped down. So I think you're right that here the question is this just, we had a great 30-year run, it was nice and informal, we got it started, thank you so much, Defense Department, for funding this, thank you, NSF, thank you, you know, original Steve Jobs, but now it's time for the new Steve Jobs. I hope that's not the case. What I want to see is a vibrant, diverse information technology ecosystem where you've got the professionalized stuff, sure, absolutely. I don't have anything against appliances outright, but we want it balanced so that people in the mainstream can still have experimentalist technologies and tools and have a way to just double-click and get to a new application without any incumbent, without anybody who's ruling the waves at the moment getting in between them and that software that they want to experience.
Well, they, you know, given that there are so many large corporations who were thinking about how it is that they can make money on devices and services and on the Internet and on providing Internet service, how is it that you deal with that and try to and at the same time try to promote this kind of openness, access, free access to information, ability to pass information around without somebody getting in the middle and saying, well, it's in my interest to place some kind of limits on what it is you can do. I mean, how and I suppose here part of what we're talking about is this thing called net neutrality.
Yeah.
How is it that we continue to keep as much as possible the Internet this very free, open, unrestricted avenue for exchanging information of various kinds?
Yes. I think the key is understanding the value of competition, not just the way we might casually understand competition, as in eight different firms trying to give you the loaf of bread that appeals most to you, But competition in a broader sense, it means competition not just among firms, but among entire models, including some models not being for profit at all, and let the for-profits compete with the non-profits in a way that has easy entry for anybody that wants to try out that idea. And in the provision of network services, it means not just trying to have two wires to the home, one from your cable provider over coax, one from your phone company over souped-up, twisted copper pair, but instead a spectrum policy, for example, that lets people experiment with so-called ad hoc networks, where there's no internet service provider nearby, and instead bits from your house get conveyed to the house next door, get conveyed to the house after that, until there's an ISP somewhere on the edge that doesn't have to worry about beating a path the last mile and the last 500 feet to your house. And being able to experiment with those technologies means inevitably you've got to have a regulatory landscape that lets that happen. And the government thinking that, well, if we just auction off spectrum to the highest bidder, and that's a form of competition, and then that bidder will have something to do with it, with its new monopoly over that slice, that seems to me not to understand what full, true market-leveling competition could mean. Now, I think most people agree that having lots of different ways to get bits to and from wherever you are will help make it that there won't be gatekeepers who start doing tricky things, because you could always switch to another gatekeeper. One of the questions, though, is, well, how do we get there? Is that an attainable state? And some net neutrality folks say that it's really hard to get that kind of competition. In the absence of it, the government needs to come in and say to the few entities who are basically the same as one another in structure competing, that there ought to be some rules laid down to prevent them from getting too tricky and from abusing what monopoly they've achieved.
And just real quick here, and I have some other folks I want to get on to, so, and obviously this is something that's more complicated and maybe you don't want to deal with real quickly, but it is the issue of security and dealing with all of those things about the free and open internet that we find so annoying, like privacy issues, like spam, like viruses, all that sort of stuff. The thing that you say drives people to maybe to actually want to close themselves in, so that they theoretically are closing themselves off from that. And there, that's here comes to your metaphor of the gated community, you know, the gated community. How it is that you can address those real security concerns, and at the same time preserve the kinds of openness that you also want.
Yes, and what I don't want to see is a retreat, even as it seems rational, into gated communities, the way that we see, for example, email dying. If you ask people under 20 how much they use email, the answer is basically not at all. They use it to communicate with authority figures, and other than that, they're on Instant Messenger, they're using Twitter, they're on Facebook, and all of those things are under the rubric of a corporate entity that offers them. It's back to AOL and Prodigy rather than the shared hallucination that is generic electronic mail as we've understood it, in part because electronic mail, by being so generic and unmanaged, has been overrun by spam. Now, just very briefly, some of the ideas discussed in the book to kind of run down the middle on this include computers that have red zones and green zones, so that you can, with one box, with one purchase, have a safe part of the computer, quote-unquote safe, that doesn't let you easily run new software, that has only approved and vetted iPhone app-style software, that has your important spreadsheets and your term papers and stuff like that, but then also a red zone, and just as easily as switching a car into four-wheel drive mode to go off-roading, you can say, all right, I want to try out this new thing called Skype, and you load it in the red zone, and even if it blows up, the shards can't escape the red zone. That's an example of trying to split the difference. Another quick example is a project I'm working on called Stop Badware, by which people will have an opportunity to download some software that radiates the vital signs of their own PCs. How happy is this machine right now, and what software is it running? And then participating people, before they run new software, can say, wait a minute, how long has this software been around? When was it first spotted? Is it brand new or has it been stable for 20 years? And what does it do to machines when it runs? Does it make them on average happier or sadder? Those kinds of things can help us start to own security even in an unowned space. And that's what I'd love to see before just retreating to the gated communities.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jonathan Zittrain. He's the professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at Oxford University and is co-founder of Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He is the author of the recently published book, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, and is published by the Yale University Press. We have about 10 minutes left. We have two callers here waiting, and we'll get right to the next. And this is someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hi. I've been listening to the show. I think it's really interesting, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. I'm thinking back, you know, I started using the Internet back in the 1980s before there was a World Wide Web, and familiar with different concepts that you're talking about. You know, and you're focusing a lot on Apple II, and I'm finding that really curious, considering all the interoperability and standardization issues that have even allowed the Internet to emerge and to become what it is today. One of the things I'm curious about, you're talking a lot about commerce, you know, and e-commerce, and what's driving a lot of the development of the Internet, a lot of the Internet-based programs, and also freedom of choice that people are making. I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on the fact that people do have free will, and they are making choices, and they are market-driven choices based on preferences and dislikes that kind of fall within that realm of technology adoption. You know, whether you're going to be an innovator, whether you're going to be one of the early adopters, or whether you're going to choose to be one of those laggards, you know, that Rogers has noted in many of his books and writings on this topic. I'm just wondering if you could kind of comment a little bit more about the cultural side of it in the whole context of what's going on with the commerce side. Thank you.
Sure. On the market choices front, yes, I agree with you that there's this puzzle that, you know, I'm claiming we're getting to a bad place collectively, despite people making rational decisions individually or seemingly rational. And the seemingly part of it is people can still make mistakes with their free will, and there are plenty of times in which we want to help them make better decisions. And in a sense, part of the book is just meant to be a wake-up call. So the way that Consumer Reports might say, to go back to the toasters, here's a brand of toaster that we've discovered catches on fire, I wouldn't want to answer that issue of Consumer Reports with, well, people are just making free choices in a marketplace. Let them choose what they want. The answer would be, well, yes, they can. We're trying to inform those choices so that people that previously would have bought a toaster that catches on fire will avoid it thanks to this new information. So in part, I'm just trying to be a market player myself and offer some thinking that might make people think twice before they get that EchoStar DVR or equivalent. Or, most importantly, I think, we often underestimate the extent to which a generative technology, one that can be reconfigured to do totally new and unpredictable things later, is a useful one at the time we're making the purchase. When we buy something, we buy it for its present uses, not generally for its future possibilities, even though those possibilities can be actualized by just double-clicking. So part of what I would hope to do is offer advice to people to better weight in their calculus the generative technologies. Now, of course, a lot of these decisions aren't being made by the users themselves. When you think about the history of it, so much of what has moved the Internet and the PC forward has been this hidden unintentional corporate subsidy, where those corporations at first were buying PCs.
Sorry.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. I'm just kind of chuckling because I'm thinking about this in terms of digital literacy, in that, you know, we've got a new need for people to be educated in terms of being digitally literate and in being able to flesh out all these points that you're talking about, in that it's this complex mix of things. And that regardless of what we give them, you know, we can make these recommendations, oh, you should do this, you should do this, you should do this, you should do this. But if they don't understand the language and we're using different language than them, all we're doing is pushing our reality of what things should be to them and then letting them decide whether they're going to pull it. So it's that whole push-pull theory that you're also talking about. And I'm finding it fascinating because you're using different language than I use when I teach these types of courses. And I see it also when I do readings. You know, you're either a technology determinist or you're a cultural determinist or you're a mix of the two, kind of from a social and technical perspective. I fall in that spectrum.
Yeah.
And so I always caution people to be careful about the language that you use and that we can make recommendations, but what do we want to push? And what do we know about the way people are going to pull things?
Right.
And, yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading your book to see what the language is in that. And that I agree with a lot of what you're saying in that, you know, we need a free market. But at the same time, I also kind of agree with others that, you know, you do need some sense of regulation in terms of just kind of keeping things manageable and in the realm of people even knowing, you know, that need to know and that want to know, but also being able to find whatever that information is.
Yes. Well, that certainly sounds good to me. And I would especially try to take to heart your point about language and about, you know, helping inform people rather than just offering them a different product that they don't understand. In the process of devising the software that I was talking about earlier that lets the machines radiate their vital signs and people get to choose on the basis of some information what to run and what not, clearly how we execute that, how comprehensible we can make it to people who don't consider themselves technologists will be an important determinant of whether it can succeed. I mean, it's the kind of thing that I gather General Motors or Honda is going to be thinking about when they design a dashboard to a vehicle and figure out what sorts of information are going to help somebody who knows enough to drive, but not necessarily much more, how to make sense out of how to operate the car and what the conditions are outside of it.
I want to thank the caller. We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to try to get one more. And this is someone who is in Champaign and in on line number two. We'll go there. Hello.
Yeah, actually, my major concern is that the Internet starts to look like what happened with television. You know, television was supposed to be this great educational thing. All these wonderful things are going to happen. And it became so commercial that, you know, when it was referred to the vast wasteland, that kind of thing. So I'd hate to see the Internet because now they're talking about, you know, that it could be coming through your television. You know, that's, again, in terms of control. And my other issue is that, you know, you said that DARPA and NSF certainly developed this, but the taxpayer paid for it. So, I mean, certainly, you know, it wasn't the point that, you know, it was still our money, you know, might have been indirectly, but it still came from us. So anyway, I'll just.
Okay. Well, yeah. And we've got about 2 minutes. So, Professor Zittering, you can take off on that any way you like.
Yes. Well, on the television point, I agree. I would hate to see the net go that way. It's funny to think that in the background, unbeknownst to most of us, there are these huge amounts of money being invested in and battles fought over the so-called set-top box. The set-top box is that stupid device that you can never get your remote control to work with that sets your cable channels so you can get the scrambled channels and such. And you would think, what's the big deal about the set-top box? It displays a number and you pick your channel. But it turns out that, you know, to this day, there are executives with lots of money behind them and lots of rationality who think that box is going to be the touchstone of control and that you'll have TV inching into broadband territory through the set-top box rather than Internet edging into TV territory through sites like YouTube and Hulu and on-demand video just through the net. So it'll be a fascinating couple years to see which beats which on that front. On the point about the taxpayer money, yeah, you bet it was taxpayer money. It's one of the best investments we have ever made. The idea that in that 30-year period, we invested to an order of magnitude something close to $100 million, which is not a lot of money. I mean, just think about some of the numbers. You know, shopping cart theft is $800 million a year. It's amazing what dividends that has paid for society. The way that a highway is supposed to pay dividends for everybody when you can get your goods and people around cheaply.
Certainly, and we're almost out of time here, so it will have to be quick. But certainly this conversation takes place within the telecommunications industry, I'm assuming within academia, people like you, and maybe in Congress. But really, where is the conversation about how all this gets managed taking place?
Well, one place it isn't yet. I can't tell you where it is. I'd love to see that conversation taking off more. One place it isn't is it's this thing called the Internet Governance Forum, which has been a rather self-conscious attempt to get people around the table to talk about some of these very important issues. It springs out of efforts by the United Nations and the International Telecommunications Union to think about the future of these technologies. And I'd actually love to see the Internet Governance Forum become more a way of bringing people together to talk about this stuff.
Well, we're going to have to stop here. People would like to read more on the subject. You look for the book I mentioned. It's titled The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. It is published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Jonathan Zittrain. He's the professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at Oxford University and co-founder of Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. And Professor Zittrain, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. It's been a great hour.